Let me repeat that. I think, as probably everyone here knows, today we're commemorating Parinirvana. And in Japanese, it's called Nehan, commemorating the death of the Buddha. And so, as you people here can easily see, but probably not people on Zoom, on the altar, the traditional sitting Buddha is being replaced by a reclining Buddha, as he reclines on his right side. And this is because he was very ill at the time of his death. And back there, where Kate is sitting, there is a large poster, which I'll talk about in a moment or two here. So, in Soto Zen, and actually through most of the schools in Japan, the Buddhist schools in Japan, and actually I believe through most of East Asia, February 15th is recognized as the day that Shakyamuni died. When Kate and I lived in Kyoto, and we lived in the kind of southeastern part of Kyoto, up on the hill, very beautiful place. We would walk to a nearby temple to see the huge Nehan painting, this huge painting of the Buddha at his death, in the Buddha Hall at the Tofukuji, one of the largest and oldest Zen temples in Japan. And fortunately for us, it was quite close to where we lived. We would walk there pretty often, and I'd sometimes run there and back. It's wonderful. And the poster that you can see behind Kate is the painting that's there. And if you could, can you screen share the, I have one image on the desktop there. I meant to let you know. Just so people on the Zoom can have a look too. That's it. Oh. Is it not working?
People on Zoom can see it.
People on Zoom, okay, oh good. Okay, thank you. Thank you. So to commemorate Nehan at Tofukuji, they would hang this very impressive painting. This painting is about 15 meters high. 15 meters high and about 8 meters wide. And it would just hung for a short time around the 15th of February. Massive, huge painting. The artist's name was Mincho, a very famous painter who lived in the Muromachi period, which is about early 1500s, that kind of thing. And every year, you know, many, many people from Kyoto and around, and including us, we would go and see this painting, very moved by its size and by its exquisite detail. Hard to see, but there's, you know, the animals below have gathered as well as people, his followers and lay people and bodhisattvas surrounding him. And as you can see, many are crying. In fact, I think in this particular Nehan, this particular picture, almost everybody is weeping. Because when we have lost a loved one, for a while, the whole world is drained of color, as if a gray film of grief covers everything. On some Nehan paintings, because this is not the only one, there's other ones, there is one that a little picture, smaller, much smaller picture that Kate and I have left on in the kitchen area from Shinnyo-do, which is a Tendai temple, at least I think it was originally a Tendai temple, a little, anyway, different school. And that one is small. It's only 6 meters by 4 meters big. But also exquisite detail. In the painting, you can see, wow, this is a lot of detail. And I looked online, and apparently the animals alone, there's like 127 animals gathered in that painting. And you'll see it, you go, shed a magnifying glass, look at them. But what particularly I find moving about that painting is that one also has a cat. And this one doesn't. And apparently there was some spurious legend that the cat did not attend the Nehan of Buddha. They were too uppity or something. I don't remember exactly. But we know that's not true. Cats, of course, were deeply moved by the death of the Buddha, and they were there too. We find in the early Buddhist suttas, the collection of texts, several places where visitors would ask Shakyamuni Buddha, what happens to a Buddha at death? But they were never given an answer by the Buddha. In India at that time, many held the view that Atman, or perhaps soul, would something would reincarnate over and over again into this Saha world, this world of suffering. And some kind of spiritual practice was the way to end the cycle of being reborn over and over again in this world. And there were many ideas about what kinds of mental and physical practices would accomplish this. And everyone thought, surely the Buddha was someone who had broken the cycle and would not be returning. But if that was the case, what would happen to him? Or to any Buddha? What was next? But when asked, the Buddha just remained silent. Or sometimes he would say, beyond description. Or something along the lines of, you don't need to know, because you don't even know your own full experience right here, right now. Stop asking irrelevant questions. The Buddha did not provide answers just to give comfort or to satisfy curiosity. There's a list of questions that he refused to answer, which is kind of interesting to look at someday. And I thought, well, you know, he's very much like the Zen teachers who came later. The Buddha knew that we, you and I, must each find our own way. That there is a great power in a questioning search that is lost when simply given an answer. The great teacher in the Song Dynasty in China, Dou Shuo Song Yue, gave this teaching to his students. He gave them what's known as the three barriers, three questions that for them to hold. The first was, when you hack through the underbrush searching for the truth, you find yourself nature. Right now, where is yourself nature? Second, realizing your self-nature, you are free from birth and death. When your life is ending, how will you be free? And the third, when you are free from birth and death, you will know where to go. When the four elements, earth, air, water, fire, of course, scatter, where will you go? Typical Zen style, right? Tell me, where will you go? So I think we can stop the screen share now. That'd be fine. Yeah. questions that haunt us today in one form or another. But from the time of the Buddha, our ancestors left us no answers to these kind of questions. But they did give us the gift of questions to spur each of us on in our practice. And it's not just the teachings and the old teachers that encouraged us. There are other reminders implanted in our tradition as well to bring these questions forward, bring these questions forward. For example, on the Han, the wooden plaque that we hit to bring us, calls us into the Zendo for our Zazen practice, is written the great matter of life and death. And so when I hear the Han, I noticed my distraction stop for a moment. And I remember, oh yeah, time to go to the Zendo. But I also remember a little bit, oh yeah, the great matter. And then I forget again, but at least I remember for a moment or two. Over the past decades, there's been much more kind of public discussion about death and dying, certainly than there was when I was growing up. Hospice, end-of-life care, and now, of course, MAID, medical assistance in dying, for example. And yet, despite all the media coverage and discussion, I think for most of us, death remains distant, almost impersonal, unless we are at the end of this life, or someone close to us is or has recently died. In the Zen tradition, this commemoration of the Buddha's parinirvana or death is again a yearly call for us to wake up from the dream that we are permanently stationed here. We are not. And sadly, no one we love is permanently stationed here either. The Buddha did not conquer or resolve sickness, old age, and death in the way we might imagine and hope for. I've noticed recently in the paper articles about some of the moguls, they're really rich tech people, putting tons of money into extending the human lifespan. Preferably infinitely, but if not, at least for, you know, a few more years, another 10, 20, 30, 100 years. But the Buddha, throughout his life, had times of severe illness. His body became tired, stiff, and painful with old age, which some of us are experiencing. He suffered bloody diarrhea in his last days, and he died. The end of life will come for me. The end of life will come for you. And what the Buddha showed us through his example is that it is possible to be fully open beyond our self-creating stories and live in this world, live a life with equanimity, joy, and compassion. You know, much has been written and said about his awakening under the Bodhi tree. And whatever that indescribable experience was at his time, we can see from the ancient records and stories that have come down to us that the Buddha from that time was mostly deeply at peace, no longer pulled and pushed by greed, hatred, and delusion. We can see that he acted with deep compassion, teaching and helping others until his body could no longer remain upright. So it's also clear that even after his awakening under the Bodhi tree, that the Buddha was still subject to the vicissitudes of life. The early Buddhists understood this as, they called it nirvana with residue. In other words, even a fully awakened one, while having a living body in this saha world, this world of suffering, is still somewhat entangled in the three poisons of greed, hatred, and delusion, and still experiences the fruit of karma, the consequences of actions. You know, Kate and I, in talks, have mentioned this a number of times, but one part of the Buddha's life story that I find very stirring is that throughout his life, Mara, the very personification of delusion in the Buddhist, kept appearing periodically in an effort to stop the Buddha from guiding others to awakening, saying over and over again, "You've done a lot of work. Take it easy. Time to go to Florida. Retire." So this was a temptation that the Buddha had to resist over and over again for the benefit of those around him and for those to come. For us, he kept teaching for all those years. There was no retirement for the Buddha. So thinking about all this, I noticed something that has come up for me, kind of partly out of this ongoing discussion about death and dying, is, you know, that phrase, the good death. People living in prosperous and a safe part of the world often these days do not simply or suddenly die anymore. It's often protracted, hospitalized deaths. And some people say, well, these are not good deaths, to die in a hospital. And maybe they're right. I wonder, what does it mean to die well? We may imagine, you know, a kind of planned, peaceful, and dignified death at home, you know, surrounded by family members. That would be lovely. But I wonder, what would the Buddha describe as a good death? I don't know. In the Mahaparinirvana Sutta, the early Buddhist text that deals with the Buddha's last days, it's written that he and a number of his monks met with a group of householders at the village of Pataligama. And the villagers invited him to stay at the newly completed village rest house. And at the rest house, the Buddha first talked about the precepts. Living a virtuous life, as he frequently did when talking particularly to lay followers. One of the benefits of a moral life, the Buddha said, among other things, is, and I'm quoting now, "one who is of good morality dies unconfused." This seems to me like a possible definition of a good death. But then I thought, oh, wait a minute, it's also a good definition of a good life. Right? A life unconfused. So, what is your sense of a good death? What is your sense of a good life? Two powerful questions for us to hold as we commemorate the Parinirvana. So the Buddha did not tell us what happens at death. But with his own life, he taught how to approach the end of life. And again, the Mahaparinirvana Sutta shows us a Buddha who is frail and dealing with the pains and frustrations of an old body. For example, here's a passage written about the last rainy season of the Buddha's life when he was 80 years old. And the rainy season is a time when the monks and nuns would stop their mendicant life, come together to practice together. And it was during this time that he became extremely ill, the Buddha. So here's the quote. "And during the rains, the Lord," meaning the Buddha, "the Lord was attacked by severe illness with sharp pains as if he were about to die. But he endured all this mindfully, clearly aware, without complaining. He thought, 'It is not fitting that I should attain final nirvana without addressing my followers and taking leave of the order of monks and nuns. I must hold this disease in check by energy and apply myself to the force of life.' He did so, and the disease abated." So the Buddha was not beyond painful physical ailments that came with old age. He felt pain, but he didn't compound that pain with a strong and ongoing emotional reaction and story to that suffering. Right. He endured it and continued as best he could for the sake of his disciples. I find it very touching, his deep compassion and concern for his followers, for the Sangha. Even facing the end of his life, the Buddha's thoughts turned towards others, to what he felt needed to be addressed before he died. And I think for the Buddha, this was not an act of sacrifice, but one of love and wisdom. Recognizing his intimacy with all life, it was a natural response, his natural response to the cries of the world. In another section of the Maha Paramita Sutta, the Buddha says to his younger cousin and attendant, Ananda, "Ananda, I am old, worn out, venerable, one who has traversed life's path. I have reached the term of life, which is 80. Isn't that the same in the Bible? No. Anyway, which is 80. "Just as an old cart is made to go by being held together with straps, so the Tathagata, the Buddha's body, is kept going by being strapped up. It's only when the Tathagata withdraws his attention from outward signs and by cessation of certain feelings enters into the signless concentration of mind that his body knows any comfort." So the Buddha is telling Ananda, and then telling us, of course, all bodies wear out. There's no cure for old age, despite what the tech-rich people are trying right now. I don't think we will have a cure for old age. Even the body of the Buddha is subject to old age and death. And for the Buddha, relief came from deep meditation, a mind focused rather than a mind dwelling on the aches and pains. It's a lesson I need to learn. I feel my knee aches, you know, at night sometimes, or, you know, my lower back. And then the Buddha continued to give Ananda a painting, a teaching. "Therefore, Ananda, you should live as islands unto yourselves, being your own refuge, with no one else as your refuge, with the Dharma as an island, with the Dharma as a refuge, with no other refuge. And how does a monk or nun live as an island unto themselves, with no other refuge? A monk or nun abides, contemplating the body as a body, earnestly clearing away, mindful, having put away all hankering and fretting for the world, and likewise with regarding to feelings, mind, and mind objects. That, Ananda, is how a monk or nun lives as an island unto themselves, with no other refuge. So this is a very famous passage, repeated a number of times in slight variations all throughout the Mahaparinirvana Sutta. But the Buddha here is not telling Ananda and all the monastics to isolate themselves or to practice some form of extreme individualism. He's simply stressing we must all do this practice for ourselves, that no one, not even the Buddha, can practice for us. He tells Ananda and us, look, if the prospect of old age and death frightens you, then practice and realize the truth of the Dharma for yourself. Do not go looking for refuge in other people or places. And Dogen gives us the same message in his writing. Dogen says in the Fukan Zazengi, a text that we have talked about many times, why leave behind deceit that exists in your home and go aimlessly off to the dusty realms of other lands? Practice right here. Learn the backward step that turns your light inwardly to illuminate yourself. Body and mind of themselves will drop away and your original face will be manifest. If you want to attain suchness, you should practice suchness without delay. So, you know, in our Zazen practice, we shine the light of awareness within and we discover for ourselves. As the Heart Sutra says, there is no birth, there is no death. There's no coming, there's no going, no suffering, no cause, no cessation, no path, no knowledge, no attainment. Again, Dogen Zenji, in his Dharma discourse on Parinirvana Day in 1249, said this, the Mara of death saw Buddha passing away, and both the Buddha and Mara laughed. Human and heavenly beings were disturbed and could not stop crying at that time. And Dogen says, do not have doubts about this mountain monk, meaning himself, neither laughing nor crying. All Buddhas in the 10 directions also nod their heads. This crying is true for common people. But how is it for patch-robed monks? You may wonder why I'm saying all this. It's because Dogen then pauses for a moment and says in a loud voice, thoroughly investigate life in order to study death. Letting go and taking hold of life and death all depends on your refinement, meaning your practice. So what do we let go of and how do we take and hold life and death? When Dogen tells us to thoroughly investigate life, he means your life. Your life. In Zazen, letting go of the stories about our lives, I think we begin to see and begin to hold up our life as it is. And perhaps this is simply another way of saying the same thing the Buddha did. We become a refuge unto ourselves. So earlier I mentioned the compassion of the Buddha during his final days, and I'd like to mention one more example. invited for a meal on his way to Kushinagara, where he his final resting place. He was served a dish by a common person. He ate it, but he forbade everyone else from eating it. And here's the quote again from the same Mahaparinirvana text. Having eaten the meal provided by Chunda, a layperson, the Lord was attacked by severe sickness with bloody diarrhea and sharp pains as if he were about to die. But he endured all this mindfully and clearly aware, without complaint. And the Lord then said, Ananda, let us go to Kushinagara. Very good, said Ananda. And then on their walk, the Buddha picks up the conversation again. He says, Ananda, that Chunda, the smith, the layperson, should feel remorse thinking, it is my fault. It is by my misdeed that the Buddha gained final nirvana after taking his last meal from me. But Chunda's remorse should be expelled this way. That was your merit, Chunda. That is your good deed, that the Tathagata gained final nirvana after having taken his last meal from you. For friend Chunda, I have heard and understood from the Lord's own lips that these two alms offerings are of the very fruit, of the very great result, more fruitful and advantageous than any other. Which two? The one is the alms offered after eating which the Tathagata attains supreme enlightenment, and the other that after which he attains nirvana without remainder, in other words, at his final passing. It was a great merit. In this way, Ananda, Chunda's remorse is to be expelled. Well, that's, here he is thinking about the guy who perhaps must have given him, you know, some kind of poisonous food by accident. So let's continue just a brief description of the final moments. The Buddha then, when they reached Kushinagara, the Buddha lay down between two sal trees. You can see in the pictures, he's in a grove of sal trees. He lays between two of these beautiful big trees. The twin sal trees suddenly burst into blossom, and the flowers fell and covered the Buddha. He then said, this covering with flowers is a great honor. But whatever monk, nun, male or female lay follower dwells and practices the Dharma properly and fulfills the Dharma way, he or she honors the Tathagata, reveres and esteems him, and pays him the supreme homage. In other words, we honor the Buddha by our practice. The Buddha then told those around him that the Dharma and practice will now be their teacher. He then asked three times if any present had questions, and when no one answered, the Buddha spoke his final words. Now, I declare to you, all conditioned things are of the nature to decay. Strive on untiringly. And then he quietly died. So, in a few minutes, we'll have a ritual to commemorate the Buddha's parinirvana. And I have always found this ritual quite poignant and beautiful. Let it remind us, each of us, to open to the endless ritual of being born and dying in each moment of this life. Let it remind us of the great mystery that includes us all. How will you live today in this moment? So I'll end with a short poem by one of the great teachers in the Japanese Zen tradition, one of the founders of Nanzenji, which is also one of the big main Zen temples in Kyoto. His name is Busin Daimin. And this is what he wrote on his deathbed. It was very customary in Japan to, your last breath, you're expected to write a poem, right? I imagine some of these guys wrote their poems ahead of time. Had them under the pillow, they could whip them out. Anyway, here's this poem, a very beautiful. In coming, I have no abode. In leaving, I have no fixed direction. How is it ultimately? Here I am. All the time. Thank you.
Page 3.
Just a clunk.